From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm your host, Kimberly Izar. Happy Saturday, it is April 25th. Well, fly tying is a beloved artistry and tradition near and dear to the Catskills. We spent an afternoon with fly tier Phil Street at the Catskill Fly Fishing Museum and Center. Rosie Starr spoke with gardener Chelsea Kelly about an upcoming workshop at the Farm Arts Collective about how to achieve the gold standard of compost. Plus, we have a special treat this morning, a short story reading with writer Karen Pavelka on her story about a conversation with a cicada. And Calcoon is gearing up for its first Ramp Fest, celebrating the beloved wild ramp. More from the Farmhouse Project's co-owner, Sean Michael Lang. All of that in Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report, but first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. A U.S. delegation is heading to Islamabad today for another round of peace talks with Iran. An Iranian delegation is also there, but officials say there are no plans for direct talks with the U.S. Alan Ayer is a former U.S. diplomat who worked on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. He tells NPR's Weekend Edition that the two sides are at an impasse.
The U.S. Navy is blockading Iranian ports, and the Iranian economy was horrible before the war. And the U.S. is feeling, the world is feeling significant pain because of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. So both sides are feeling significant pain, but perversely, I don't think either side really is yet gotten to the place where they're eager to negotiate. So we'll see what happens if, in fact, there is a meeting.
The Pentagon says the U.S. blockade of Iranian ships and ports would continue for as long as it takes to get Tehran to agree to a deal. The government of Argentina says it wants to reopen talks with Britain over the Falkland Islands. A leaked Pentagon memo suggested Washington might review its position on the British Overseas Territory as punishment for the UK's refusal to join the war on Iran. The BBC's Mimi Swaby has more.
Argentina's sovereignty claim over the Falkland Islands, which it calls Las Malvinas, is not new. It has often been used as a rousing call by presidential candidates vying for voters, but the heated, long-standing debate has been reignited by the leaked Pentagon memo. And apparently emboldened by this, on Friday, Argentina's president, Javier Milei, an ally of Donald Trump, posted on social media in capital letters that the islands were, are, and always would be Argentine. His foreign minister said Argentina wanted to restart negotiations with the UK, something London does not want to engage with. It says the territory's sovereignty rests with the UK.
NPR has not independently confirmed details of the leaked memo. The Justice Department says recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program are not necessarily shielded from deportation. It's the latest move by the Trump administration to strip away protections for the 500,000 people who are brought to the United States illegally as children before 2007. NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports.
The decision comes from the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is an administrative court that hears appeals from immigration courts. Both are part of the Justice Department. This case centers on a DACA recipient who was detained by Customs and Border Protection while boarding a domestic flight last summer. She was later released from immigration detention in October, and a federal immigration judge said that her DACA status protected her from deportation. The Department of Homeland Security has appealed. It argues that DACA protections are not absolute and are subject to discretion. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole. Pennsylvania's primary election is Tuesday, May 19th, and the last day to register or change your party status to vote in that primary, it's only a week away. Elizabeth Estrada is the democracy editor for VoteBeat PA, and she advises Radio Catskill listeners in Pennsylvania to pay attention to those dates and deadlines.
You know, the deadlines are so important. You really have until May 4th to register to vote. May 19th is election day. Make a plan. And if you're choosing to vote by mail and you want to request a mail ballot, make a plan for that as well. You have until May 12th to request that. So just making sure that you're aware of these deadlines so that you can make sure to participate in this election to make your vote count.
Spotlight PA also reports that the 2026 primary races are likely to shape the Pennsylvania House and Senate. Of course, which races are on your ballot will depend on where you live.
We have a few statewide races this year, but also there's a lot going on in terms of the state Senate and the House. Folks can visit spotlightpa.org/elections and look at some of our candidate guides and voter resources as well. But for things that are more specific to your district, take some time to research and figure out who it is that you want to vote for.
Again, Pennsylvania's primary is May 19th. The deadline to register to vote in that election is May 4th. For more voting info, visit vote.pa.gov. Vote.pa.gov or check with your local county elections office. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at cfosrny.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Farming Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, Wednesday, April 25th, was Earth Day. I hope you all had a moment to pause and think about the many, many ways you contribute to this beautiful planet of ours. You know, here on Farming Country, I like to think that we celebrate Earth Day every Saturday because we bring you stories across the region from farmers and producers and people who tend to and steward our lands every single week. And so this week, we're kicking it off learning about slimy, slippery creatures. Since 2008, Hudson Valley students have been working with New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation to count juvenile American eels. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Elias Guerra has more.
Brenda, Liv, Carlos, Richard, and Ariel are students at Poughkeepsie High School. They were recently at the Fallkill Creek by the Mid-Hudson Discovery Museum with their science teacher, Mark Angevine, for a very particular science project. They're counting young American eels. Liv, Ariel, and DEC science educator Sarah Mount explained that juvenile American eels are called glass eels, and they're transparent.
Do you want to see the heart inside of one of the clear ones?
Yes, please.
Yeah, you have to look so closely, and then you can see their little hearts beating.
Yeah.
That's one of the really cool things about glass eels, is that because they're transparent, you can see their internal organs.
See a little.
So if you get super close up, you can see his heart beating. Do you see? Up by his face.
It looks like a little splotch.
Educator Sarah Mount, who is accompanying the student group, says American eels are mysterious creatures that have declined in population but are on the rebound. She said historically, the eels may have made up the majority of the fish biomass in streams like the Fallkill. Mount says in the past 19 years that they've been collecting data, they've seen the eel population slowly recovering. Where they come from, though, is a question that the likes of Aristotle and Sigmund Freud studied and pondered.
Because nobody has ever seen eels spawning in the wild. I say that they spawn in the Sargasso Sea, but nobody's ever actually observed adults spawning. That's just the general region of the ocean where scientists have caught the smallest larval eels. And people have been asking the question of where do eels come from for thousands of years.
Mount says American eels can live up to 30 years, grow up to 3 feet long, and will go back out into the ocean to reproduce just once.
Do have gills. They have gills, they can breathe underwater, but they also can absorb oxygen through their skin. So they're like a super-powered fish. They can do really amazing things. They can swim out on land on a wet, rainy night. They can come out and like get around some of those barriers that I mentioned are still an issue.
Some challenges for eel populations include dams and barriers that block migration, historical overfishing, pollution, habitat degradation, and water quality changes. The students catch the eels with a fike net that looks like a Y-shaped cone It goes into a funnel and sits on the rocks where the Fallkill meets the Hudson River and is used to catch eels coming in from the ocean. The tides from the Atlantic reach the creek, causing its water level to rise and fall. Brenda, a student who has been part of the Eel Project for 2 years, says the work is fascinating, and she likes that it's hands-on.
For me, it feels nice having them like slip in your hands and like counting them. Like, that's the joy of like nature, because nature provides, nature protects them. So yeah.
And you're not scared of them at all?
No. No, because I've been touching snakes since I was a little kid, guys.
I said the same thing.
Sarah Mount and science teacher Angevine explained that the count helps educate the community.
Yeah, you guys are doing real science that's contributing to real management decisions, to real actions
down the line. This data has been included in places where no other citizen science data has ever been accepted, but our data got in. So it's high-quality data.
After an hour, the students pack up, but they will be back again this week to continue the count.
Now, the females are going to be bigger than the males. Yes. The females go further upriver than the males.
Live longer.
Yeah. Okay. We're just like that.
Hashtag girl power.
And nature too, guys.
That's right. The women are smarter.
For the New York Public News Network, I am Elias Guerra.
Thanks to Elias for that report. So the Catskills kicked off trout fishing season with the first cast. I popped into the Catskill Fly Fishing Museum during the first cast weekend a few weeks ago, which, you know, it's such a beautiful space to learn about the long history of anglers in our area. And it was here where I first met Phil Street. He is a longtime fly tier and fly fisher, and he was doing a fly tying workshop there. And watching him tie a fly was absolutely fascinating. And so I recently sat down with Phil to learn how he learned how to fly fish and more about the process of tying an American dry fly.
Hi, I'm Phil Street. We're sitting in the Catskill Fly Fishing Center and Museum, surrounded by a lot of local history and exhibits of fascinating flies, right next to the willow emock.
Phil, tell me a little bit about how you got into fly tying. What did that look like?
Well, you can probably tell my accent. I'm not from New York, but I learned fly fishing from my grandfather, which is probably what a lot of people will tell you. And that was obviously back in England, in the Southwest. And you know, he taught me with a cane rod, which was really interesting. And he taught me to tie a few basic patterns, and then a lot of time passed by and I got interested in other things, but recently moved to the Catskills and got involved in the community and the museum and the Catskill Fly Tiers Guild, and that kind of reignited, you know, a passion in fly tying and the history around here. So, you know, learned from some friends that I made in the neighborhood, and we're tying a lot of Catskill dry flies.
And when you were first learning how to tie flies, what was that process like? Was it frustrating? Was it exciting? A mix of both?
I mean, I think every fly tier will tell you they tie a fly and they notice something that they wish they could have done better. And it's kind of a process of constant improvement. Like, it's, you know, you focus on the tail or the wing or the body, and you always notice something. Oh, that's a little off. And then you keep trying it again. I don't think anyone ties a fly and thinks, oh, I got it perfect this time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's constant improvement. You know, taking photographs of your flies is a great way to really kind of get an appreciation for how you could improve. So that was a great help.
In front of Phil Street on a large table is a typical kit for a fly tier: different types of feathers, hooks, threads, and several different types of dry flies.
We have a number of flies. Can you kind of just walk me through how they're different from one another and what they look like for folks who are listening?
Yeah, a lot of these are traditional Catskill flies. So we've got a ginger quill here. So this has got a quill body, which is actually this is a quill that's been stripped from a peacock eye. And so stripping it exposes the really fine kind of stripes and segmentation down the body. So that's that quill, that's on the quill Gordon fly as well. But the ginger quill has obviously a ginger hackle, which kind of makes it, you know, quite different, and a different wing. This has got duck slip wings, but, you know, turning to a fly that's uses the traditional wood duck wing, you know, this is a Hendrickson here. So you've got a wood duck wing and a fox fur dubbed body, and that's an early mayfly hatch, which we should hopefully see in, you know, 2 to 3 weeks, but fingers crossed.
Then, with a small metal rotary vise that helps someone rotate the hook, Phil delicately walks me through how he makes a dry fly.
Okay, so this is some very fine thread or silk that was traditionally used. And so, you know, the first thing to do here is to just get that onto the shank of the hook, and then just wind that back. And so we just snip off the excess. And then I just kind of wind that back all the way to the point of the hook, just to kind of get that thread base. And then we come forward. And one of the most important things, these flies are so small, right? And how they act on the water and how they balance, getting the position of the wing is the first thing that you need to do. So you kind of stop the thread at where you're going to tie in the wing. And that's most critical, because if you get that wrong, everything else is going to go wrong as well. The body's going to be too small or too big. The balance isn't going to be right. So that's the most important thing.
And if you make that error, is there a way to correct it you're going?
Like, the best thing when you're starting out and when you're thinking about tying flies, a good approach is don't move on to the next step until you're absolutely happy you got that step right. And then think about, I'll redo that step. Just, you know, so just take your time. I take my time tying flies. No point rushing it. So that's where the wing is going to go. And then we talked about wood duck flank feathers. And so this is this nice kind of lemon golden color with, you know, the striations and the nice markings across here. And it's a strong material. And this is a material that sort of was uniquely discovered by, this goes back to Theodore Gordon from like the 1890s, mm-hmm. when they first started thinking about using wood duck flank feathers. So in a lot of traditional Catskill flies, they use wood duck wings. So that's what we're doing here. And I'm just kind of stripping back on a couple of wood duck feathers, stripping back a lot of the fluff and just revealing these nice strong barbs that are going to make up a pair of wings.
They're so delicate.
Yeah, everything is really delicate. I mean, surprisingly strong when you've tied a fly. If you imagine, you hear stories of people that catch, you know, 20 fish on a single fly, and or parts of it are getting chewed up, but it's still working. And, you know, they're very resilient. A lot of people, when they're starting out, they're tempted to want to use way too much material. And even flies that you might buy in a shop, people are kind of drawn to a lot of material. You feel like you need to have material for the money that you're spending on a fly. But really, you know, an effective fly, you know, one that you're going to fish successfully with, is very sparse.
With one hand holding onto the thread and the other hand to guide it, Phil Street starts to create the shape and lengths of the fly's wings.
What are you doing now?
So now I've stripped back a couple of wood duck feathers, and I'm lining it up with the hook. So I mentioned like proportions and the balance is really important. So what we have to do here is measure the length of the wing, and the length of the wing should be about the hook length. So let me just get that here. So we've got two feathers lined up, and so I'm just laying it across the shank of the hook, bringing it forward. I measured using the hook itself, and now I'm just going to trap in this wing with a couple of turns of thread. And the location of the wing is really important, and the length of the wing is really important, and that's what's going to give it that kind of Catskill, traditional Catskill proportions. So now the wing is in place, I can trim off the excess and just tie it in. And then I'm going to come round the front after having tied it in, and I'm going to separate the two wings, so they're two distinct wings. and also taking off my glasses so I can see a lot better. And then what you do is, you know, what we call sort of posting the wings. There's a couple of wings here, so we go round the back and just post that a few times. And then we come around the front and do the same for the other wing on the other side. And these are called, you know, divided wood duck wings.
Mm.
When they first started making these Catskill dry flies, when Theodore Gordon was tying these, he would have like a single wing, but then at some point they evolved to being divided wings.
Mm.
And then I did this like figure of eight around the wings to kind of help support them and help separate them. You can see that starts to resemble an upright wing.
I'm still so amazed at how fast you did that. when you were first starting out, how long did the process take you? And is it just a matter of like practice and time that where you get faster?
I think, patience is really important, and definitely practice. And focusing on one aspect of the fly, and maybe just like spending a week just on wings, you know, and that's just feeling like you're getting the wings right. Because if you don't get that right, everything else becomes more difficult. So then, you know, then it's the body, like practicing tying the body of the fly and then the tail, you know, and eventually you just kind of keep refining what you're doing until the whole fly kind of comes together at one point.
Street says he always fishes with his own flies. The feeling, he says, is something really special.
I mean, I think in fly fishing, there's so many different aspects of fly fishing. You know, some people build rods. Some people just, you know, love tying flies. There's a lot of, like, artistry to it and creativity to it. There's something for everyone. People that aren't into that, they just love being out in nature and standing in a river, and if they catch a fish, it's kind of a bonus as well. But nothing better than catching a fish on a fly that you've tied. I've yet to catch a fish on a rod that I've built, but maybe one day.
Phil, anything else that you want to share about the joys that fly tying and fly fishing, especially here in the region, brings you?
Yeah, I think, you know, in this day and age where people are, you know, on screens so much and, you know, everything's kind of digital, like spending some time out in nature and doing creative things like this is just perfect. So I would definitely encourage people to come to the museum and learn more about the history. And, you know, the Catskill Fly Ties Guild is a great place to kind of learn fly tying with a nice community. And one thing that surprised me is just what a nice community it is, and how, you know, welcoming it is. So get involved and get outside and try fishing. There's plenty of people around to help.
Thanks so much to Phil for that conversation. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, the latest from Keith Hubbard.
This week on Cat's Cast, we're back in Pine Hill, where a town of just a few hundred residents has spent 25 years building something remarkable. A community center offering art, music, pottery, and lots more.
I feel like we have become a space for folks to really age in place, and I love that so much because I think I move back and I hope to age in place here, so.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
The satirical newspaper The Onion is taking over InfoWars, the media empire created by right-wing blowhard Alex Jones, and replacing the hate with comedy. Why?
I think people need to hear other people like me remind the world that this is insane. Otherwise, people feel like they're going crazy and that they're alone.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC. This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, you know what time it is. This week's Star Talk Report with Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. The full moon will occur on Friday. The moon will sit on the opposite side of the sky as the sun. Consequently, the moon's face will be fully illuminated, and the moon will rise around sunset on Friday and will set around sunrise on Saturday. The moon rotates once on its axis at the same time as it orbits once around our planet. The result of this synchronicity is that the moon always shows us the same face. Friday's full moon coincides with the moon's farthest distance from Earth. The point of the moon's orbit farthest from Earth is known as apogee. When a full moon coincides with apogee, the moon is called a micromoon. The moon orbits Earth not in a circle, but in an ellipse. This means that one side of the path is farther from Earth than the other. As a result, the moon's distance from Earth varies by 31,000 miles as it traces its orbit through space. The moon's average distance from Earth is 239,000 miles. Friday's micromoon will be 249,000 miles away from Earth. When viewing the micromoon, it may not appear smaller and dimmer than usual. Even though the moon is considerably farther from Earth during a micromoon, the difference in size is difficult to see with the naked eye. This will be the first of two full moons in May, with the second full moon occurring on May 31st. If you are afforded clear skies tomorrow night, venture out to gaze at the spectacle that is the micromoon. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard, reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks so much to Keith for that report. Well, composting is a really fabulous way to repurpose your food scraps and your waste. But how exactly does it work? And how do you achieve that, you know, black gold standard compost that is really, really good for your garden soil? Rosie Starr spoke with Chelsea Kelly over the phone. She's an environmental educator, urban planner, as well as a gardener, about an upcoming workshop at the Farm Arts Collective called Backyard Composting with Chelsea.
Chelsea, I understand that you are presenting a hands-on workshop that dives deep into the science of composting. Tell us what participants can expect to learn on May 9th at this two-hour workshop.
Absolutely. So Farm Arts Collective invited me to come and do this workshop. As you mentioned, I'm based in Brooklyn, so I've got a lot of experience working in the city and urban environment, but I'm excited to work with other folks in the Damascus area and work with people in the Catskills region, where there's a lot more space to do composting. So what you can expect from the workshop is a little bit about the science behind compost, like why should I even care about composting? How can it improve the soil and plant health in my garden or in my broader community? And how can I reduce waste? We'll also be covering how can I compost at home? What's compostable? Some people may have heard the term browns versus greens. How do we get the right balance? I'm going to demo some best practices in the kitchen because that's really where your habits for composting start. I'll be giving an overview of different types of backyard devices, which all have different benefits and depending on your family size and your space constraints, there's going to be a different fit for everyone. And then we're going to go through some demos to demo best practices for the ultimate soil and plant health. So how do we make compost? How do we apply compost to plants? How do we tell if our compost is working its magic so that we can have these amazing plants in our garden? And then we'll be going into a Q&A.
Oh, I'm sure the audience will have lots of questions. Starting with something like the gold standards, I understand your background includes experience in making the gold standard for compost. What can you tell us about that now?
When we talk about composting, which I got my education at Earth Matter New York, which is an urban farm and a nonprofit organization, a learning center based on Governor's Island, which sits between Brooklyn and Manhattan.
It's a really special place. I encourage anyone who's visiting New York City to take the ferry over to Governor's Island and go to Earth Matter to experience their garden and learn about a large-scale composting. But also they have demos for backyard devices and goats and chickens and all that stuff. It's unbelievable. You can find that in the middle of New York City. Earth Matter is open every weekend to the public. But when we develop the gold standard for compost, we call it black gold. And the first thing I learned at Earth Matter is that compost is magic. It truly is the representation of our life cycle here on planet Earth, where we have natural materials that are composting and then regenerating to give our plants what they need. So rather than doing the song and dance with what's the right pH for my soil, how much nitrogen, how much phosphorus, what are all these different things that I need to add to my soil, you can add compost and it will do its magic. So the gold standard is you can tell it's good when it is this really dark, crumbly, earthy smelling material. That's what we'll be talking about in the workshop, is to really understand through touch and demonstration what that really feels like and looks like.
Well, that's really good that you'll be able to offer the participants a visual, because if you're like me, you're always asking the question, my compost doesn't look perfect. It doesn't look like this picture. Am I doing something wrong?
I experienced the same thing, Rosie, before I kind of got educated. So I have the great fortune of actually having a backyard in Brooklyn, and I have a tumbler device. So a tumbler is something you're supposed to spin it around. It's got two chambers. You've got little things on the side where you can control how much air is coming through. But in order for compost to thrive and for us to have our best compost, it's really, keep in mind that it's made out of four different parts: nitrogen, carbon, air, and water. So you really, in order to get all of your food waste, which is your greens, which is the nitrogen, and you want that to decompose to get this beautiful gold standard compost, you're also going to need to add your dead matter, which is leaves and wood chips and maybe some sawdust, maybe ripped pieces of paper and paper towel, and that's your browns and that's your carbon. And then you're also going to want to continue to monitor it to make sure it's going to have the right amount of water and air, because if it gets too dry, it's not really going to do its thing and work its magic and decompose into this beautiful gold standard compost. And yeah, so you need to make sure that it's getting the right amount of air and the right amount of water to kind of do its thing. And it's really on a weekly basis for most of the backyard devices I'm going to talk about in the workshop. There are some techniques to just kind of check in with your compost and make sure it's kind of doing its thing. I mentioned the tumbler. Another big part about composting is turning it and giving it movement. That's not always the case. Sometimes if you're okay with a more passive system, there are systems where you can kind of just throw it and let it sit and kind of see what happens over time. But if you're really trying to kind of get some compost by the end of the growing season to regenerate your soil and get it prepared for the winter months, you know, you're going to want your compost to kind of, over the next 3 to 6 months, work some magic for your garden.
Well, speaking of working magic on the garden and composting, I know that Farm Arts Collective is hosting this event on the Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm. And Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm grows beautiful, healthy, delicious vegetables, herbs, and has garden rows of colorful flowers for bouquets. It can only mean good, rich soil. What I'm remembering is Tanis on her Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm did a theater performance called Decomposition by Farm Arts Collective. And Tanis used as a prop a heap of beautiful compost. And I just think it's suitable that this workshop is taking place on the farm there. the black gold standard that you're speaking of. They certainly know how to make compost.
For sure.
The other organization that's tied to your event that day is SEEDS. SEEDS organization stands for Sustainable Energy Education and Development. They strive working in communities for sustainable and healthy futures using efficiency, conservation, renewable energy, and local food production for the good of everyone.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting when we have different organizations collaborating together to ensure that we are able to make meaningful impact with people to get them in better habits within their own homes. It's a pretty amazing thing to be able to see the full life cycle from the food we eat to the food we grow in the span of our own homes and even in a year or so.
Okay, let's remind listeners when the event takes place. From what I understand, the Backyard Compost event takes place Saturday, May 9th.
Backyard Composting with Chelsea, that's me, will be at the Farm Art Collective at Willow Wisp Farm from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. on May 9th, Saturday, May 9th. You can get your tickets at farmartscollective.org.
Yes, and Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm is located at 38 Hickory Lane in Damascus, Pennsylvania. But more information is available on the website farmartscollective.org. And yes, the event takes place. It's a two-hour workshop Saturday, May 9th from 10 a.m. until 12 p.m. What else would you like to share with the audience before we close?
What I'd like to share with the audience is one really simple message is that we can all do our part to make this world a better place for future generations. And learning how to compost and learning how to do it right, it is really easy. It improves your life. It improves your mindfulness in the kitchen. It improves your eating habits. And it's knowledge that I'm really excited to share with your listeners.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Farm and Country. We look forward to May 9th and Backyard Compost with Chelsea Kelly at Farm Arts Collective on the site of Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Rosie. Thank you so much for having me.
While prepping for this conversation with Chelsea Kelly, I learned a bit of science that I'm going to share with you. It adds more mindful inspiration to my compost mix. Here's the question. Why should we keep compostables out of the landfill? The fact-based answer is, apart from being a wasteful resource, when organic waste is sent to landfill, it rots and releases methane, a greenhouse gas with 21 times the global warming impact of carbon dioxide. For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr.
Thanks so much to Rosie for that report. Just a reminder, that workshop is going to be coming up on Saturday, May 9th. It's from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. in Damascus at the Farm Arts Collective in Pennsylvania. We'll take a short break, but when we come back, a short story about meeting a cicada. That's up next.
You know that phrase, a force of nature? On the next Selected Shorts, we've got four strong stories to blow you away. I'm Meg Wolitzer. Tune in.
Selected Shorts, Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Last week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Alzo Slade learned the danger of using AI for medical advice.
Yeah, it told me that I was going through perimenopause.
I'm Tom Papa, filling in for Peter Sagal. I promise you'll feel great when you join us for this week's news quiz on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. What would it be like to be or think
or even talk to an insect. Because that's what writer and scientist Karen Pavelka's short story digs into. She recently read her short story about a conversation she had with a cicada in her home at the Catskills Writers Guild. Today she shares and reads it to us here at Radio Catskill. Karen, we're going to get to the story in just a moment, but first off, just welcome to Farming Country.
Thank you for having me in.
You know, when I had originally read this short story, I was like, all right, we have to have a conversation. Because it was just so fun. I'd love to just hear, you know, just first about the origins of this, as we were talking about journal entry that became a short story. Mm.
It was just something that happened that I wanted to write down because it was a good memory. And I know how I see the world, but there's all kinds of creatures out there and I don't know how they see the world. And when you have something that small and that fleeting in your home, a bug in my window is no big deal to me. But to the bug, it's a really big deal. It really is. So I wanted to see it from that perspective.
So this story is about a cicada. And I'm curious, so is it a true story?
It's a true story. It happened.
And, you know, one of the things that I love about while I was reading this is just that the story is so vivid. From like the descriptions of identifying the cicada to what you were thinking as you found the cicada in your home. It's also really, really funny. And I'm curious, like, how did you decide that you wanted to tell this story in this way?
It's just the way it came out. Just the way I was regarding this visitor with dead seriousness and the way it was regarding me as well. There was no holding back from either one of us.
Yeah. So. Before we hopped into the studio, we were talking about how you're a writer, but then you also have this long history of being a scientist. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what that transition looked like and how your background in science informs your writing today.
Background in science means that I try to look at things with open eyes and not just from my own perspective, but to see from different angles, what the truth might be.
And you're also part of the Catskills Writing Guild. Tell me a little bit about what it's like writing alongside other writers, especially in a region this special.
We meet once a month and people bring in snippets of whatever they've read or whatever they've written, pardon me, to share with others. So we take turns listening to each other and we take turns critiquing each other's writing. It's a very supportive group. It's very fun. It's very special. We meet the first Saturday of every month at 10 o'clock in the Red Church in Roscoe. So if anybody wants to show up, that would be fine. We each get, you know, a few minutes and people make comments or not comments. And it's, as I said, it's just a very supportive group and everybody's got everybody else's back.
When you read your story to the rest of the group, what were some of those initial reactions?
Some of the initial reactions were, it's nice to see something from that perspective. It's fun to get both sides of the story, or what I assume are both sides of the story, because I'm not actually fluent in cicada.
Maybe that's something that we all need to train in.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, let's hear that story. Here's Karen Pavelka with her short story.
One fine day last summer, just as the sun came up, a fascinating stranger came to visit. Because we had a significant language barrier, I have to fudge some of the dialogue in the telling, but I promise you, this tale is true. My unexpected houseguest surprised me in the soft, warm August dawn. As I tottered into the kitchen, eyes still gummed with sleep, fumbling ineptly for the coffee maker, an alarming sound immediately brought me alert. A harsh, clattering buzz rattled inside the kitchen window. A wasp? I wondered. Go gently, it sounds huge. The noise ceased when the creature settled upon the sill. Approaching the window, the first thing I saw was a large, translucent wing. It seemed delicate as a spider web, yet powerful enough to create that grating racket. Was it a fairy? No, it can't be a fairy, I told myself. The lore doesn't say they sound like a phone book ripping in half. Not a wasp, either. Maybe a dragonfly? Oh, so beautiful. Early pink daylight was snared in the insect's wings, panes of cellophane clarity in a structural web of black veins. The clear sectors caught the soft, new light like prisms, refracting it into pastel shards of stained glass. Gold, green, and lavender. It was a summer cicada, not a red-eyed prime-year brood cicada, but one of the common random-year types, just a large, simple, bewildered bug. Feeling my approach, the creature turned sideways to take my measure. Though its ways were foreign to me, we shared an understanding which transcended plain speech. I could sense the emotions behind its enraptured stare at the world beyond the glass. "Look! The light!" exulted the insect. "It dazzles me. For years I lived alone, underground, knowing only the safety of darkness and the sweet sap of tree roots. Then I molted and I transformed into this creature with eyes, with wings. Yesterday I crawled from the earth and was born into the sunlight. The world is full of brilliance and the trilling song of a million others like me and the glitter of wings. We all have wings." The creature turned to face the window again, extending a complex, multi-jointed leg with an exquisitely formed little claw at the end. That claw scratched wistfully against the smooth, clear wall of glass. "I know my kind are out there. I hear them with my whole body, calling my name, yet I cannot reach them." Agonized, it moaned. "Why have these bug eyes glimpsed heaven? These angelic new bug wings formed to fly me there, only for me to be denied that destiny now." The cicada sighed out through all 10 pairs of spiracles and said, "My kind relies on safety in numbers to succeed. Delectable as we are, predators can't possibly eat every one of us before we lay new eggs. Now I'm trapped somehow, alone, obstructed by a barrier I can neither see nor understand." Shuffling its six legs in a graceful, complicated dance, it turned to face me fully and admitted, "I'm out of options. I can't bite, can't sting. I'm just a big wad of juicy bug meat. I've not rehearsed this scenario. Get it over with quickly, because these eyes, my wondrous new eyes, incredible as they are, these eyes cannot blink. Go ahead and eat me." The injustice of the cicada's plight wrenched my heart. "Ah, no, my philosophical arthropod ambassador," I murmured gently. "I am mesmerized by your tragic tale of unfulfilled grandeur. Delicious and crunchy though I'm sure you are, the destructive hunger of humanity is not reason enough to end your story now. Please, my accidental houseguest, if you would." I extended my hand. The cicada tapped my fingers curiously with its delicately clawed front legs before climbing into my palm. It faced me, silent and steadfast, awaiting whatever fate was imminent. I opened the window, pulled away the screen, and thrust my hand outside. "Swiftly now, be off," I cried. "Defenestrate thyself. Glory awaits." The stunned insect processed the change. Morning light rising all around, the caress of the breeze, the clamorous calls of its fellows in the woods. Joyously, it launched skyward on those loud and many splendored wings. It flew high into a treetop, rejoining the collective without a backward glance. A short while later, I carried my cup of freshly brewed coffee to the porch. From every direction, a symphony of cicadas screeched praises for this glorious new day.
Excellent!
Thank you.
Oh, that was so fun. That was so beautiful. Karen, while I was listening to you read it, I was curious, as you were writing this, what was your favorite part about writing it?
My favorite part was when the cicada basically turned to me and gave up, because that's what they do. They're not aggressive bugs. They're large, gentle, sad little bugs, and I couldn't hurt it. How could I hurt a bug like that? And I wasn't hungry enough to eat it, so... You know, I just, I had to let it go. I had to make sure it got away.
You had to let it go. Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. Well, We just heard Karen Pavelka reading her short story about a conversation with a cicada. If people want to hear or read more of your work, is there a place where they can find you?
No. No, I'm writing a rather long book in the process, and I'm nowhere near being published. So the only place I read aloud usually is Writers Guild in Roscoe once a month, where there are many, many talented writers reading their work.
Well, I think our listeners got a very special treat this morning then. We've been chatting with scientist and writer Karen Pavelka. Thank you again so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me here.
You're listening to Farm and Country here on Radio Catskill. I'm Kimberly Izar. Ramps, a North American wild spring allium that tastes similar to garlic and onions, often mark springtime here in the Catskills. And this May, the Farmhouse Project is bringing the first ever Ramp Fest to Calicoon. Joining me on the phone now is Sean Michael Lang, co-owner of the Farmhouse Project and Black Walnut in Calicoon, and organizer of Ramp Fest. Just a quick listener's note that the Farmhouse Project is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. Sean, thank you again so much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, this is going to be the inaugural Ramp Fest that we're going to have here in Sullivan County. Tell me a little bit more about the celebration and why the decision to focus on ramps.
Well, I mean, if everyone is familiar with ramp, it is a kind of a prized culinary ingredient here on the East Coast, and it is the first sign of spring. It's one of the first plants that you could forage in the woods that tastes incredible. It's kind of a cross between garlic and an onion, and they could only be foraged, and they have a very short season time, usually mid-April to mid-May. Owning a restaurant and store in Calicoon, we thought it would be a great way to tie into a spring event and have it themed around the ramp season, but also we're all longing for spring and gardening. So an event that focuses on all things spring.
I think it's safe to say that all of us, after a brutal winter, for the most part, is definitely looking forward to more sunshine. The interesting thing about ramps is that even though, you know, it's unique to our particular time of year, there's a lot that you can do with ramps, which I think gets to maybe some of the talks and demos and town happenings that'll be happening throughout Ramp Fest. Talk to me a little bit about some of the different workshops and contests that folks can expect.
Yeah, so we really wanted this event to also be educational. And so we're having Stephen Schwartz, who is a ramp expert, and he hosts ramp picking experiences on his farm. And he's actually going to be here talking about sustainably harvesting ramps. There is a certain way to harvest ramps just so they grow back year after year, whether it's cutting just the leaves off or pulling them from the bulbs. You have to do it very strategically, just so they keep growing year after year in the same patch. We're also having Laura Silverman from the Outside Institute come, and she is doing a ramp kimchi demo utilizing ramps, and she's also going to be talking about foraging for ramps and mushrooms and all things to forage in the spring. And we're having another ramp demo from Chef Dale, who is doing a ramp bisque demo, which is kind of like a ramp soup. So there's so many things that you don't think you could do with ramps, whether it's sweet or savory.
Okay, all of this sounds absolutely delicious. And I'm looking at the website, and I also see a ramp baking contest. What's that about?
Yeah, so we're hosting at Black Walnut a ramp baking contest for any home bakers or savvy bakers to come and bake
their ramp base bake, and we're going to have a few judges, and we're going to crown a star ramp baker.
And, you know, I'm curious personally, what is your favorite way to incorporate ramps into your cooking and just as a way to welcome the springtime here?
I love making ramp pesto, which is amazing because you could freeze it and have it in the middle of winter when you're longing for spring. My partner, Chris, also is a home baker, and he loves to do ramp focaccia. That's another one of my favorites. And then Camille, who is our chef at Black Walnut, she loves incorporating ramps into different pasta dishes. So you'll see that, too, coming soon to our restaurant.
I think I'm going to have to add ramp focaccia to something that I explore in the kitchen sometime soon. One thing to note for the event is that it is a family-friendly event. Are there events specifically for, you know, young children or kids that will be available?
Yeah, so it is a town-wide event, and the hub of Ramp Fest will be at the Calicoon Train Depot, which is right in the center of town. But we also are having a kids' tent, which will be really fun. It's Wild Ramp Kids Tent, and we're going to do a little foraging hunt for ramps, and then there's some face painting and some other cool garden-themed kid events, too, that are all free for our community.
Just before we sign off, you know, Ramp Fest is going to be on Saturday, May 2nd, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in Calicoon, you know, along Lower Main Street. Anything else that you want to add for folks to come out?
No, I think we're hoping for a beautiful day. And if not, we have tents ready to go. So we'll be prepared. And it'll be a great event to get outside and support local businesses in Calicoon, and to also have some fun and longing for some springtime weather.
We've been chatting with Sean Michael Lang of the Farmhouse Project about Ramfest happening on May 2nd. Sean, thank you again so much for chatting.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
A few other things happening in the community the next week. Today, April 25th, the Pocono Environmental Education Center presents an Earth Day Festival from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Dingman's Ferry, Pennsylvania. It's going to be rain or shine. It's a family-friendly event that has, a ton of crafts and activities, music, food vendors, and a live animal presentation. And then tomorrow, Sunday, April 26th, the Mammocating Environmental Education Center will host its workshop, The Ruby-Throated Hummingbird. That'll be from 1 to 2 p.m., and this program will cover hummingbird adaptations, flight, diet, nesting, migration, and predators. They'll also discuss nectar feeders as well as native nectar plants that attract hummingbirds and keep them coming back. More events on our community calendar on our website at wjffradio.org. And that is all for this week's show. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Up next, it's CatsCast with Brett Berry. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. I'll catch you next week.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
On This Old House Radio Hour, cyber thieves are trying to break into your house through your Wi-Fi. Here's how to stop them.
There's a way you can actually see who's sitting on your network or what devices are still on your network. And so what I would do is remove them.
Plus, comedian Alonzo Bowden on the horrors of the comedian's condo. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Greetings, theater fans. Tom Candela here. Coming up this week on Curtain Call, I sit down with Tanis Kowalczyk and Jess Beveridge of Farm Arts Collective. We're going to look back at the return of Lucy Joseph and how that piece evolved across two runs and then turn our attention to their new flagship production, The Scattered Seeds of Troy. Plus, we'll preview the next chapter of Dream on the Farm and what's ahead for the rest of their season. Catch it Monday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill.